This is The State of Things, live from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, just a few years ago, scientists discovered that mice can sing. They make lyrical tunes, not unlike birds. We can't hear them because their voices are pitched outside of our range of hearing. And it turns out that elephants sing too. Can't hear them for the same reason. They're pitched too low. So what we're talking about here is biomusic, and that is the music produced by nature. So Patricia Gray is here. She is a clinical professor and senior research scientist of biomusic in the Music Research Institute at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Patricia Gray.
Hello.
Claire Wright is also with us, a musician education student at UNCG. Claire Wright, nice to have you with us as well. So the two of them are analyzing music recorded from microphones placed on the ocean floor. Patricia, tell us about this project. Where are these microphones and what are they doing?
Of course. Let me begin by saying a little something about what biomusic is. The second part of that word, the music part, is now being discussed as music as a complex communication system. So I'm not actually investigating whether there are any animals in the ocean that are creating sonatas or symphonies or something like that. We're talking about the musicality of animal communication systems. And because human beings, our species, if you're a normal human being, you are born with a whole suite of musicality within you that you don't have to learn. You know how to find the beat in some music that you're listening to. You can remember melodies, and you can sing them back, you know, in some manner of some kind. So when this whole biomusic program began at the National Academy of Sciences in 1986, it was to extend the conversation of human musicality into other species. And so over the years, we have been doing a very interesting set of research subjects that include elephants, that include mice, that include our great ape cousins, bonobo apes. I've just come back from a rhythmic entrainment that means, do our bonobo cousins actually know how to find the beat when they're hearing music? And so consequently, when you think about, you know, how are you going to extend this conversation into other species, one of the most interesting areas to start going into are the oceans, because it's very, very difficult to see in the ocean. For anybody who's ever swum in the ocean or has dived or whatever, you know that depending on the particular quality of the water that day, the tides, storminess, how deep you go and so on, eyesight, vision, is not the primary way to know what is going on there. So we were contacted by the government of Mexico that knows about the biomusic program and also knows about our connections to a much larger listening project that's going on in the international research arena. So Japan and Canada and Europe and, you know, various parts of the U.S. are engaged in very interesting new research that is focused on listening.
Well, let me ask you about that research in particular. Are you more interested in the native ability of whatever species you're investigating to perceive sound as music, or are you also looking at their ability to communicate using sound?
Yes, the presumption is that, like us and many other species that we've investigated, that the sound around you gives you a lot of information about whether this is a safe space. Is this a place where you want to bond with others? Is it really an alarming place? So, for instance, if right now We heard a whole group of very loud sirens right outside this building. We would all get very concerned. And so that's pretty much the way we approach our research, is what are the sounds? We call this kind of space, the sound space, a soundscape. So what is the soundscape that actually attracts species to specific areas? And what are some of the sounds that are considered to be alarming?
And so one of the things you need, if you're going to do this kind of research, is a good ear. And it's great to have the analytical ability of a scientist, but to have the ear of a musician would really be valuable. And Claire, that's where both of you come in. But Claire, you're listening to these sounds that get recorded. Tell us kind of what you're listening for.
Well, right now I've started the research this past summer, and I've really spent the bulk of my time just listening and trying to get acclimated to the sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a different sound than what I was expecting at first, and the soundscape is so thick with different kinds of animals that it takes a while to get acclimated to the sound and be able to pick out the different sounds that are happening. So I'm looking at patterns over time, tides and seasons, and the effects that have on the sound in my recordings.
Well, let's listen to one of them. We'll get a feel for the kind of thing that Claire is listening to. Let's listen. Sounds like bacon cooking, but I guess not, huh? It's something else. And first of all, tell us where that was recorded.
This was a recording from Mujeres, a hydrophone that is off the coast of Mujeres.
Where's that? And tell me where that is.
Well, let me just sort of set up what the context is. Mm-hmm. Right now. We have hydrophones. Now, these are really sophisticated listening devices that mm-hmm. lay on the ocean floor for 6 months at a time. And they are programmed to come on every 30 seconds and record for 30 seconds and then turn off. And they do that for 6 months at a time. We also have them programmed so that they are recording at a very, very wide frequency range beyond our normal range of hearing. So we're getting a lot of really wonderful data. We've picked three very different sites for these hydrophones. And by the way, they're called ears. They're ecological acoustic recorders, ears. And so one of the sites is a barrier island called Isla Cantoy. And it's a designated wildlife preserve.
Where is this? It's off the coast of Mexico, right?
It's off the coast of Cancun.
Cancun, okay.
All right. I know. Everybody says, oh, you have your office in Cancun.
That's right. That's right. And how deep is it?
All right. In this particular site, we chose a cove that is highly protected part of the Mesoamerican Reef, which is, by the way, the second largest reef system in the world. It flows from Honduras all the way to the top of the Yucatan. A very, very delicate, very important wildlife site. So Isla Cantoy is a barrier island. The cove that we chose, we know, is not going to have any boat sounds there. And so we have this particular hydrophone is about 9 feet deep. And so it's a probably the most pristine area. The second site is off of Isla Mujeres, and that's what Claire's going to describe in a moment. Now, that site is outside the barrier reef in the migratory channel. So we're capturing all the animals that are flowing north and south in the Atlantic or making the left turn to go into the Gulf. So we get cetaceans such as whales, dolphins, etc. So that's a very interesting site. And that hydrophone's about 45 feet deep. Very different acoustical situation. The third site's a very interesting experiment that the government of Mexico decided to do. They have created an underwater sculpture museum. they engaged in a commissioning project. It's a multi-year project with a renowned international sculptor by the name of Jason Taylor. And so he has been making these fabulous sculptures that are then sunk, and they're intended to draw the divers and the snorkelers essentially away from the barrier reef to give them something more interesting to look at. And so we worked with that sculptor to create a sculpture that actually houses our hydrophone so that we can actually listen to the kind of anthropomorphic sounds that we humans bring to this soundscape setting. And just for those of you who are interested in seeing what that is, I thought we were pretty clever, and that we created this big torso. It's about 8-9 feet tall, and it's like a standing torso, and Jason went and molded the ears of all the kids in Cancun and stuck these ears all over this this sculpture.
Yeah.
And then our hydrophone ear sits in the back, and so consequently this particular sculpture is called the Listener. So we have
sense.
Very three different sides.
And it takes great humility for a sculptor to make do all that work and then drop it in the ocean. So, you know, congratulations to him for that. So I want to hear a part of what we just heard before, Claire, and then maybe you can tell us what it is in particular that we're listening to here. Let's listen. Okay, once again, where is that, and what are we hearing?
That is the hydrophone off of Isla Mujeres, and this is, I believe this is a low tide clip, clip from low tide. I've noticed...
So now tell me, is this the protected cove again, or is this the channel?
No, this is the one that's in the migratory channel.
Okay, so
that's
lots
45.
Of things going on there.
Yes,
yeah.
And the majority of the sound, the kind of crackling noise that you hear, that's kind of like rain falling, or I liked that description, bacon grease. It's snapping shrimp. There's millions and millions of them down there, and they're incredibly loud animals. And then you also, I don't know if you also heard a little bit of a kind of burping noise, but that was another fish.
Well, let's hear. We've got a second clip, and that might be more clear in this next clip here. Let's listen. Maybe not.
Yeah, you could hear the in the beginning of the clip. It's a little bit clearer.
And that's a little clearer. So now here my question, and so what are we hearing there? That kind of that banging, or there's the snap, high-pitched snap, and then something a little more low-pitch rumble.
Yeah, that'll be probably a fish. I'm going to work.
Swimming by.
Right. I'm going to work this summer to try to get better at identifying different fish species so I can listen and I can recognize.
Well, that's my question. How do you know if you can't see it?
Well, there's a great database on Cornell's website. They have a huge database of animal sounds, and UNCG Library also has a large database of fish recordings. So my job is to listen through all of those and many, many times, and then I use a computer program to filter out sounds and then use it to filter through all the tens of thousands of recordings that I have to find those same sounds in all of them.
So you're like that weather radar where I can filter out the ground clutter. That's you. You're a human hyper viper Doppler radar. What is all that stuff
but,
in front
but
of your radar?
Just,
but how did so now I want to know about the interpretation process, because yes. If we have a library and the sounds are already collected, clearly we don't just want to identify them. So now what do we do, and what do we learn by listening to them over time?
Exactly. So as you were saying, you know, it's one thing to just say, okay, now we know, you know, that there's a zebrafish there, or there's sunfish, or whatever. But that's not really the story. The story is what makes for a healthy soundscape. What are the elements that impact change in animal behavior? So, for instance, you know, this kind of work is extremely interdisciplinary. So we're working with seismologists, for instance, who have very deep listening equipment off of Honduras and Belize, because when there is an earthquake in the ocean, then that has a sound rippling impact on behaviors, on throughout the soundscape that goes really for 1,000 miles. And so those are those larger macro understanding of what the soundscape is and how it impacts behavior is going to eventually lead us to a perspective where, for instance, we have some invasive species of fish in these very important waters. There's an Asian fish called a lionfish, which is a beautiful-looking fish, but it has no natural predators, and so consequently, it's overrunning those species that are innate to these waters. Well, are there ways that we can cue sounds that will actually change the behavior of lionfish? That's one of the things that the government of Mexico is very interested in.
I think a public radio fund drive. just keep repeating 1-800-966 over and over again, and out they go. But not without giving us their credit card first. So but this is a very cool idea, because what you're saying is you're getting a baseline. So then when the disruptive thing happens and you go in and listen, you now have a baseline to compare it to.
Exactly.
And then you can start becoming less analytical and more predictive and
prescriptive. Let me just sort of tie this in with your previous story about the tree ordinance, for instance, in Greensboro. One of the things that we know in the biomusic world is that we have gone in and recorded the natural wildlife preserves in some of our national forests. Now, we all know that there is a licensing procedure that allows certain trees to come in and be selectively cut by certain companies. And visually, it doesn't look different. But when you make a recording before and after, the sounds of the participants, of the animal participants that rely on being there together, has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. It becomes an anemic soundscape space.
And this is based on something a guy named Bernie Krause did.
That's
a while
right.
ago. Tell us a bit about him. We don't have too much time, but if you can mm-hmm. get it to us in a minute, it'd be great.
Sure. Bernie and I are great pals, and he and I have been collaborators now for about 14 years. And Bernie is one of these fabulous, daring bioacoustic people who go out into the wilds and he's been doing this, you know, for like 30, 40 years now, and will sit, you know, in grizzly territory in the northern right. wilds of Alaska and make these fabulous recordings. So consequently, for instance, in Bernie's work, you have an archive that shows a huge longitudinal perspective on the richness of the soundscape over a great period of time. And that becomes a very important measuring stick for us to understand how sounds have impacted. I mean, we're doing a mockingbird study right now on our campus that is based on an archive that of recordings of mockingbirds that were made about 30 years ago. Now we're looking at a whole new set of spaces because the buildings have changed, the landscaping has changed. Has that changed mockingbird behavior? Yes.
And interestingly enough, what he found was that as you selectively, when you deforested some of these places, the flora would come back. So we'd see the vegetation come back pretty well, and it looked the same, but it was a very distinct lack of animal life that came back that you could detect with the ear that you otherwise wouldn't detect with the eye, and I think it's fascinating stuff. I wish I had more time, but I thank you both for being on the program. Patricia Gray, clinical professor, senior research scientist of biomusic at the Music Research Institute, UNCG. Claire Wright, a music education student at the same school. Thank you so much for being on the program. Coming up, an online database for terrorism, but first the music of Evan Olsen.
In the light of the dawn, with my rosy glasses on, I can see everything in my life I'd ever want. I hear the birds, they sing to me, fascinating.